the fashion industry in the UK is about £100 billion. It's huge. It's bigger than the car industry and the aeroplane industry put together. Every brand has a model as the face of that brand. That needs to be respected.
We have here with us today John Horner, director of Models One. 2008. That was the year that I got signed to Models One after I left Britain's Next Top Model. This podcast is about innovation, sustainability, really looking to the future of fashion. And the future of modelling looks like technology is going to have a massive impact. We have been trying to understand how we can best protect models in light of this innovation. How did it all begin for you?
I was on holiday with a friend and she happened to work at a company called Models One, and they asked me if I could advise them, because I have advised businesses generally. It's changed hugely. I mean, it isn't the industry I came into 25 years ago. Today, every single job comes with a digital element.
What are the implications of these technologies or models, and why should we be taking it seriously?
There's manipulation of imagery, which AI is jolly good at, and there's recreation or creation of imagery, which AI is getting better at, over which we have no control. I saw some quality work the other day of a model, and they were able at the flick of a button to rejuvenate that to a 14-year-old. Technology is phenomenal. It's very expensive, but it's getting cheaper by the minute.
Clients can't just change
the
body shape or the colour of somebody's skin,
which we've seen
with Shireen Roux. An image was taken of her and she was absolutely whitewashed. Her race was totally removed. Fast fashion brands who are going to be using these digital versions, it's a tool for them to oversell, because now they have a model that doesn't tire, doesn't age. How do we go about this? Like, what are the current complexities?
The government is taking it so softly. It isn't a soft issue, it's a hard issue, it's real, it's now. In other countries in the world, the model has more rights than they do in the UK. The most derogatory expression I've heard is that the model is a clothes hanger.
That makes me boil inside.
Yep. 100% right.
We have here with us today John Horner, director of Models One. We actually go back a very long way. Back to 2008. Ah. I actually worked that out the other night. I was so shocked. Can you believe it? Because that was the year that I got signed to Models One after I left Britain's Next Top Model, the show that Models One were associated with. You also head up the BFMA. I'm going to try and say this. The British Fashion Models Agents Association.
BFMA for short.
Yeah, much easier. Can you give us a bit of an intro into the BFMA and what you do?
Well, the BFMA was born out of what was the Association of Model Agents. And the Association of Model Agents was set up, believe it or not, 50 years ago in April. And its primary function was to look after the interests of models, the welfare of models. And over a period of time, the problem we had is that we didn't have our head above the radar and we were a bit invisible, and we were kind of a business talking to itself and not talking outwards and recognizing some of the bigger issues that face the industry. So we elected to change the name from the Association of Model Agents to the much more complicated British Fashion Model Agents Association. The reason we called it that is because we'd become officially affiliated with the British Fashion Council, hence British Fashion Models. And by being affiliated with the British Fashion Council, who is a recognised body by government, we've managed to get a seat, not quite at the top table, but a higher table than we were at before. And I think we're increasingly now being called upon by various government bodies and various other organisations to deliver the voice of fashion and from a modelling perspective. So I think it's gone well. BFMA is nearly 5 years old. We've only got 18 members, probably 20. I'm going to Glasgow to see one tomorrow. And I hope there's one other will join. So we'll have 20. And I would say we probably represent about 50 or 60% of the fashion model sector. And there's a big difference between fashion models and models per se. And there are something like 10,000 models represented by our members, which is a lot. I won't go on too long. About 60% of those models are foreign, 40% are British. So we have a broad base of models with all sorts of interests and complications and issues and so on. So it's there to protect the welfare and look after the welfare of models. That's our fundamental role.
And I know you do a lot of work across many of those areas. I mean, visas for one, I know is definitely a challenge.
Brexit was a challenge. I don't want to bore on about Brexit. However, visas is a big challenge because starting in April, another event in April, the European community is now introducing electronic entry and exit mechanisms for your passport, so they will know exactly how often you've come in and left the country. And no one is allowed to work or live in Europe for more than 90 days in every 180. So there'll be monitoring models. At the moment, models can get in and out pretty easily. We've had some models sent back from the border.
Really? Or
the borders. Yeah, quite a few across our members, because basically they don't understand what they have to say. So they'll arrive at the border and the border officer says, "What are you doing here?" "Well, I'm coming for a modelling job. Are you being paid?" "Yes." "Goodbye, leave the border." And then some models try to nip in some lesser airports, and they're the worst because there you've got border people who've got nothing else to do. And a very tall, pretty young lady walks through the door, and of course, guess what? They get sent back. But it's a big problem because, believe it or not, those 27 member states have 27 different visa requirements. And as you well know, a model has to work and gets confirmed within 24, 48 hours of the job.
Yes.
And if you haven't got a visa for 27 different countries, it makes life very easy. So we have a big, big argument going on with government, trying to get them to reopen the negotiations so we get what's called reciprocity, so that we make it easier for them to work with us and vice versa. It affects the music industry in a big way as well, so we're very much in that. But there are all sorts of endless things. We deal with different government departments in different ways, so we're kept pretty busy.
Yeah, I remember those calls. "Jade, you've got to run to the airport right now. You've got a job. Have you got your passport on you?" "No."
Yeah.
Quickly running back home, quickly run to the airport. And in London, that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. And now if you haven't got a visa, not a problem
gosh.
But it's going to become a problem for sure.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Well, we have been working together in the past year on something a bit niche,
yep.
I would say, but relevant and quite a hot topic, and something that's going to become more prevalent within the industry, and that is the implications of digitizing models in the industry. I mean, what this podcast is about: innovation, sustainability, really looking to the future of fashion, and the future of modeling looks like technology is going to have a massive impact. I mean, it already has a massive impact. So through my PhD research, which is exploring sustainability and innovation in fashion, and you as head of the BFMA, we have been trying to understand how we can best protect models in light of this innovation. But I kind of want to just go back basically a little bit to like how you started within the industry, how you came here, within the modeling industry. How did it all begin for you?
By mistake.
like all good mistakes happen.
My background is advertising and marketing, and I was in that sector for many, many years. I started my own agency, I sold it. I won't go into my history, but anyway, at a given point I was on holiday with a friend and his wife, and she happened to work at a company called Models One. And they'd been offered a management buyout by the people who owned the company, who'd started the company. And the company was started 55 years ago. So they weren't quite sure what that meant, and they asked me if I could advise them, because I have advised businesses generally. And I looked at it and I thought, this is an interesting business. So I helped raise the money, get the banking sorted and everything else, and we got investment and so on. And then eventually they said, who's going to run the business? And there were two head bookers who were doing the buyout, and they kind of looked at me and I said, well, okay. So I thought, this is a easy business, I'll turn it and leave in 5 years and do something else. And my father rang me up and he said, what on earth do you think you're doing? Modeling, dear boy. Anyway, I joined the modeling industry, and 25 years later, I'm still there, probably the oldest model agent in the world. But I think the great thing about where I sit in the modelling industry. Partly, I don't get hugely involved with the day-to-day running of booking models and so on, hardly at all in reality. I run it as a business. But we are surrounded by young people. And by that, I don't particularly mean the models, with all due respect to them, but the staff that we have. In most agencies, a lot of the staff are very young, and they're very fresh, and they're full of ideas. And I think it's a good thing the industry has to stay young. The people who sort of are involved in it need to be young, because it's a massively fast, evolving industry. Mm. You know, in the time I've been involved, I know we're going to go on to talk about that perhaps, it's changed hugely. I mean, it isn't the industry I came into 25 years ago. So,
I mean, we can definitely talk about that now, because I know that it changed even when I started, you know, e-commerce coming in. And
yeah, I mean, when I started, first of all, there's very little data about the industry. Unfortunately, we don't share data amongst ourselves. It's a very secretive industry. And it's very what I call mama and papa. A lot of the model agencies are run by individuals who own their companies, and they've been at it for a very, very long time. And they're a little bit suspicious, I suppose, about sharing information with one another. On occasions, we've had to do it for industry reasons, I suppose. But we had data going way back when I first joined the industry. I looked at the data, and the internet hadn't kind of been invented. And it began to happen. And we used to throw in the internet for free for a job, because nobody knew what it was about. And then gradually we began to learn about it, and we thought, hang on, we're giving all this imagery away without really understanding what's going on. And way back, if I look back maybe 10, 15 years, I would say what I would call web communication in its broadest sense then was about 5% of our total business, absolutely nothing. Today, in reality, every single job comes with a digital element. And I would say that if you call it digital now, it represents 70% of our business. Huge sea change over the years. And I think the early glamour of modeling, when you had glamour shoots and models and teams would go to Africa and film with elephants and giraffes and do wonderful things, and you had iconic photographers as well as models in the time. A lot of those days are gone, and digitization has kind of spoiled the fun of it. I suppose if anything's changed, it's the absolute glamour of what modelling used to be about in the years and years and years ago. You know, you had catwalk models, and the clothes were designed around the model that did the catwalk. Mm. Whereas today, the clothes are there, and the models arrive, and
they're kind of pinned behind.
They're pinned behind the scenes. Yes. Which is a great thing, because that may have an impact on digital catwalk, I think.
I hope. It's interesting. I feel like it's a bit of a two-sided kind of argument, really, because that change allowed people like me, I think, to kind of come into the industry a bit more, I guess, a girl next door. Like, I could work for e-commerce. I wasn't very tall. I'm actually quite short for a model, so I would never have been able to go in the catwalk. So in a way, it has done that. But then it's also, you know, I think it's quite saturated now. There's so many, and you're not sure where your image has been used. It's really hard to track. I remember going into my agency in New York and then telling me, you know, Instagram is 5% of your business. This was back when Instagram just started. You're going to have to do selfies. You're going to have to, you know, curate your page. And I was like, absolutely not. I don't want to do that. I feel so uncomfortable doing that. And now, had I, maybe, you know, probably would have led to more jobs and stuff like that. It's really...
Well, yes, no, it's interesting. I mean, use the word curate. I think there are two things about that. One is that models are used to being the other side of the camera. So to be on your own side of the camera is very difficult. And I think you must become much more self-conscious when you're photographing yourself than when somebody else is photographing and lighting you and so on. And we found that during COVID, not very many models were able to produce selfie videos, which every client seemed to want, you know, and the model doing their own hair and makeup and everything else. So it was pretty difficult, I think.
I am still terrible at it. I cannot take a selfie for the life of me. I will not show them. I so trust the photographer and the makeup artist and everything, and they need to make me look good.
You look good anyway.
Oh, no, thank you. But they need to make me look a lot better. And I think this is when, you know, when we're talking about, you know, digital models, we're actually removing a lot of that.
Well, I think one of the things that talk about catwalk, for example, is there's a huge amount of and it's hugely pre-planned, and every show is always late because nothing's ready. And that alone is an indication of how digitization will have difficulties. I mean, the designers haven't got their kit together till the very, very last minute. I'm never quite sure why. And there's a lot of spontaneity in the way that it all comes together at the end.
Yeah.
So that will disappear if it's all digitized. And I think the other thing is the flow of garments and the natural way in which fabric behaves is something I'm not convinced that digitization will absolutely deliver. But we're going to talk about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm kind of going to give some context. I think it's important just to understand, like, why we came together on this. So, as I was saying, like, my PhD is looking at the digital transformation of fashion and how technology plays a vital role, particularly with sustainable development in mind. And I didn't want to just focus on how it impacts industry, but obviously how it impacts people. You know, we're talking about models today. And actually, I was experimenting. This was about 4 years ago. I had the chance to experiment with lots of different emerging technologies, such as digital scanning, which is when photogrammetry, volumetric, where it creates like a photorealistic version of you, a 3D version of you. Motion capture, CGI, which can create avatars. Some cloth simulation, actually, which, yes, I agree, is still needs a lot of work. So I had all these like digital versions of myself. The one that worried me the most was the kind of photorealistic, because you could tell it was me. But what really struck me when I was experimenting with this, and maybe it was because of my like modeling background and I understand how important image is, I was really worried that I'm really concerned. I wasn't sure if I even owned these digital versions of me. And I felt they kind of was like an extra level up of having a 2D image. You know, it had so much data, personal data, valuable data to me entrenched within it. And I thought, surely I need to have more ownership of this digital version. And it actually kind of turned out that, you know, we were right to be concerned, because there was models already been scanned by actual clients for e-commerce purposes. So basically been scanned, the model doesn't have to turn up on set, they just have to use her digital version. I guess it could present some opportunities, which we'll discuss, but also a lot of ethical challenges and risks. And then we can even go on to AI, which, you know, opens up a Pandora's box. But I mean, from your standpoint as, you know, somebody who's there to protect models and you can see the industry changing so much, like, what are the implications of these technologies on models? And why should we be taking it seriously now at the very, very beginning of this?
I think one of the lessons is, as I said earlier on, that we kind of ignored the internet and the web in the early days, and we had no idea the direction in which it was going to travel. And I think the same is now true for AI, which is we really don't know the direction in which it's going to travel. Mm-hmm. It's here, and I saw some quality work the other day. Some Polish people had generated static images, I have to say, of what would be very detailed facial close-up, should I say. Yeah. Of a model, and they were able at the flick of a button to juvenate that to a 14-year-old and down to a 10-year-old. And it was quite extraordinary. I mean, this technology is phenomenal. It's very expensive, but it's getting cheaper by the minute, and it's getting better in terms of quality by the minute. So it's not going away.
Mm-hmm.
How quickly clients are going to adopt it, I'm not absolutely sure, but we've got editorial adopting it already. We've had AI generated imagery on the front of Vogue. We've got photographers like Nick Knight who's loving it and doing fantastic things with AI. Mm-hmm. I can understand all of that. But when it comes to the commercial use of AI, that's when we have to be concerned. I don't think we should fool ourselves for 1 minute that it's going to go away. It's not. And I think from where I sit, I think that it will work alongside the acting role of a model. So I'm hoping that what will happen is that models will continue to be used in the way that they've always been used for e-commerce in particular, because I think that's where AI will have an advantage for clients. But I think that, if you like, the lead will be a model, and then theoretically that model's imagery will have been captured in a manner that the client will have to get permission to replicate and will have to pay for the replication of it.
Mm.
So there should become, if you like, a scale of fees, because if the model isn't, if the client isn't having to do photography again, theoretically why should they pay again for the photography bit? But then the model should be rewarded because they're using the model again. So I think there needs to be a scale of fees established. We're not allowed to fix prices, we're not allowed to do that, but we can talk about the principles. And I think the principle of, if you like, a day rate, which is the basis upon which a model is normally paid,
mm-hmm.
Is then you get what in advertising or in TV commercials, you get like repeat fees. So if the image is used again, a repeat fee has to be paid. And that is negotiated on the basis of the day rate. Sometimes it may even be more, sometimes it may be less. But what you don't want to have is for the model to have her imagery or his imagery left in a box for the client to pick up and use anytime they choose, because that's fundamental, if you like, it's simple, it's not fair, it's not right, it will destroy models' livelihoods and so on. So we have to be, as much as we can, quite strong with clients to make sure that the usage rights of AI imagery, if it's generated from a model, obviously, has to be controlled, and we have to do the best that we can to do that. But I still think, and I do believe, that models will still be required. So I don't see the industry for live models, if you like, shrinking. I think what clients will do is they'll learn to be able to use that imagery more widely than they did before. So, for example, if you take an e-com image of a model wearing a pair of Levi's, crudely, full image, they may want to change the shape of that model a bit. You don't want that to happen as the model. You want to be protected. Mm-hmm. You don't want to suddenly have wide hips as opposed to narrow hips. That has to be protected. But what they might want to do is just simply change the color of the jeans, or they might want to turn the image of the model into more angles or whatever than they might otherwise have done. So I think there are areas of protection and there are areas of and of exploitation which would be bad. So I don't think it's all bad. I think we have to learn to work with it, not try and fight it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think just like kind of setting boundaries so that clients can't just change the body shape or the colour of somebody's skin.
Which we've seen.
Again, with Shireen Roux. You know, or even, you know, wearing something that they don't feel comfortable wearing or not wearing, you know, if they're removing items of clothing. So it's just kind of making sure that, I guess, clients don't see that image as something that they can just play around with.
No.
Yeah. And also, you know, we have to think about, I guess, the consumer who's looking at that image as well. There's a responsibility there.
We're having a bit of a backlash, I'm pleased to say. Which we've seen where consumers have seen imagery fake alongside real, and they're not happy about that. And there was a Levi's created a total AI coloured AI image of a model of colour,
mm-hmm.
and they said they didn't have to use the model. Point is that the world at large then screamed back and said, "Excuse me, so you're now going to not have to use a model of colour just because you can create one. That's disgraceful." So it kicked back in Levi's face pretty badly.
Yeah.
So the consumer is not 100% happy about it at the moment. I want to see the real thing. And at the moment there is legislation where cosmetics brands have to say these eyelashes have been extended artificially and stuff like that. And I'm hoping that that will become a necessity around AI-generated imagery. But it can't be microtype. It's got to be big enough that people can see it. And I have a feeling, and it's no more than that, that consumers won't be feeling great about buying clothing off or anything off an AI-generated thing, because that's all it'll be. if it's completely indistinguishable from the real thing, then of course they'll never know.
Yeah.
That's another thing. But I do think there should be legislation. And that's a whole other discussion, is legislation.
They absolutely should. I mean, you know, with even with photoshopping, there was a whole backlash on photoshopping. Yeah. I remember going on a shoot once, and it was for The Body Shop, and it was the first time they'd never used, one of the first time they didn't want to use photoshopping. They use extreme lighting, but at least they didn't, you know, manipulate the image after. And like you said, all these commercials now that are out, it all says that they've been enhanced in some way. So why doesn't it apply to something as extreme as this, really? Yeah. And I do remember I was going to bring up the Levi AI diversity fallacy as well. And I think definitely people fought back quite quickly, and I think that was a great thing to see. Because obviously, you know, it's not just on a like a professional level, and we're talking about people's livelihoods. It's also on a personal level as well. It can have a massive impact to the model. I know that Shireen Wu, I listened to her talk, but basically she was on a catwalk, and then after the catwalk an image was taken of her, and she was absolutely whitewashed. She was like, just her race was totally removed. It was really damaging to her on many levels. I think, and also the fact that she felt like no one was listening was even worse. So I think everyone has to be held accountable when they need to be, and this is exactly one of those reasons. Absolutely. AI can be a tool for good, but also let's not use it. So I guess the complexities of, do you know what, when we talk about usage, I'm going to talk about that a little bit, because I think it's quite important for people who don't know what usage means for a model. It is, you know, by contract, the boundaries that you set in place to be like, these are the amount of time this image can be used. These are the types of images that can be used, whether it's like a campaign, an editorial. These are the territories. It can be in the UK. I mean, tell me if I'm being wrong here. I've been doing this for a long time and I'm still doubting myself.
You could be a booker.
But these are the usage terms. But but, you know, these terms still apply, but I guess it's just more difficult to kind of track them and keep them within those usage boundaries. Yeah.
They apply less and less, unfortunately.
Right.
If you go back to television advertising, you got what were called repeat fees. So every time the commercial was repeated against a set number of audiences, i.e. numbers of people able to watch it, so the model got repeat fees, and some models got huge repeat fees for very long periods of time, like Tia Maria's advertising, which ran for about 15 years. Very, very happy model. Repeat fees are pretty well gone in the television market. People do buyouts. They buy for the whole job. And sometimes they look at 2 years usage, which is unbelievable. 2 years worldwide, which is even more unbelievable. Because a lot can happen in 2 years to a model. Their career trajectory might go up, 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 up. And what they don't want to have is old images of themselves doing e-commerce at a time when their career is developing in an iconic and different direction. So I think that's a significant factor. The problem with usage, however, in the context of digital and in the context of the web, if you like, we used to negotiate with ASOS, regional digitality. Good word, isn't it? And when they were UK only. And we helped them get off the ground. We cut our prices. Lots of models took lower rates to help the company got off the ground. But they got bigger and bigger and bigger. And we tracked their usage. And when you read their annual report, they boasted that their reach was global. And suddenly there was this little English brand which was reaching the world and selling to the world. So models' imagery was being exploited worldwide. By that brand in particular markets, not every single country in the world, but I mean, for example, America, well, that's a pretty huge platform. And that's just kind of not fair. The model wasn't being paid any more for his or her imagery being selling brands commercially in all sorts of markets, even that the model may not have wanted to be in. You know, you might have been selling product in Russia for all you know.
Well, I worked at ASOS, so now I know.
Your images are there, or it might be in China. Who knows? You may not want it to be there. So it's a worry, because I think there's less and less control over where imagery can be used. But I think going back to what I said earlier, which is extra usage, not in terms of geography or in terms of different media in which the imagery is shown, but extra usage in terms of the frequency of use, is something that we should be working towards. And we are actually working towards that at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, brands like, you know, fast fashion brands who are going to be using these digital versions, almost it's a tool for them to oversell, because now they have a model that doesn't tire, doesn't age.
Well, if you're Naomi Campbell, for example, you can create a digital image of yourself, which can be moving, walking, talking, and she need never work again.
Yeah.
And she need never get cross again, because it's just her digital imagery. She doesn't have to turn up on time.
I mean, I guess, she doesn't wake up for what, the famous quote, for, you know, so maybe the value Linda for her Vangelisa. Digital image will probably still remain the same. But for a lot of us, the working models, I am sure it's to cut costs.
Of course it is. It's absolutely about cost. The whole thing is about cost. It's not about enhancement or improvement. It's about cost. Having said which, I do think it will allow certain brands to be more flexible in the way in which they portray their clothes. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's okay, and I accept that. But I agree with you. I think, you know, there have to be constraints put on it. It cannot just sit there. Imagery cannot just sit there forever. It's wrong for both personal and professional reasons.
I feel like I'm going to touch upon this, because I think this is a one that's kind of, this particular aspect of this has caused most controversy, and maybe kind of like, you know, a two-sided argument to this, because, you know, when a model is photographed, whether people know it or not, models actually don't own that image, right? It's the photograph, it's the photographer that owns the image of the model, and we're aware of that. But, you know, with these kind of creations of these 3D versions and all the personal data that comes with it, you know, the biometric data. So when I said, you know, it's like your measurements, or you can even take out how you move. I know with mocap, you know, you could move like Naomi Campbell if you wanted and put into a different avatar. So there's a lot of, like, you can kind of break down the data, and almost each part has value. But anyway, the ownership of all of that together, I guess, and I've spoken to some and they agree that, you know, the model should probably own that version of herself, but they're not going to be able to afford, obviously, a working model is not going to be able to afford to have themselves scanned and retain ownership and store that kind of image safely. So how do we go about this? Like, what are the current complexities? Can you see it actually happening down the line, that a model owns their data?
Well, it's interesting. I was talking yesterday at an event with a member of parliament, a potential minister of a member of parliament, about ownership of imagery and the like. And he'd been involved in the art world, where now artists' work, if it is resold, a proportion of that resale price goes to the artist.
Mm.
So it's arguable that if an image of a model is resold, then a proportion of the value of that should go back to the model. And for example, Getty Images could sue a model if a model is using an image of herself in a piece of art, if they've got the imagery from Getty Images, if Getty Images bought that rights.
Even though it's her in that image.
And we've seen that happen, not with Getty as it happens, but it has happened. And that's just kind of fundamentally wrong. I mean, the model should own part of the image that the photographer has taken, in my judgment. And in other countries in the world, the model has more rights than they do in the UK.
Interesting.
I mean, France, for example, you have much, much more safeguards about photography and the like.
Right.
But all of that said, yes, photography at the end of the day owns the rights, unless they've sold those rights to, often as not, an editorial company or a magazine will often buy the rights for photography, not paying much, I dare say. So where do we go from there? Well, the problem with AI is who owns the rights, as you said. I mean, is it the client that has generated the image, or is it the client who's paid the advertising agency to generate the image, or the client who's paid the genius behind the black box who's created the imagery? Where is it? And the truth is, nobody knows at the moment, because in theory, it's the creator of the software that makes the image who would own the copyright.
Mm.
But it is not clear.
Mm.
So it's a complicated area, and it varies market by market, by which I mean geographical market by market. I mean, for example, the UK is way behind the curve compared to Europe and America. And America's on a different curve to Europe, but they're accelerating fast, looking at legislation around AI and where it can go. And I think Britain, we take what we call a soft touch, which I mean, it's pretty feeble. I think that's no touch at all, frankly. Something has to be done. You know, we can't just leave it where it is. It's not good enough. And it's not just models. It's every aspect of people's image rights and protection, you know. So I don't have an answer where it's going.
But well, hopefully we'll keep working through it and find out down the line. But yeah.
But it's annoying in a way. I mean, it's not. It's more than annoying. It's worrying that the government is taking it so softly. It isn't a soft issue. It's a hard issue. It's real. It's now. And, you know, everybody talks about it going in the wrong direction and so on. And Rishi Sunak hosted Elon Musk talking about this, that and the other. Frightening. So they pretend to take big notice of it, but actually they're not doing much to safeguard.
Well, this is it, isn't it? It's about safeguarding. It's about protecting people. And it's, you know, the younger generations are very aware of how valuable their data is and, you know, been much more want to control their own data and privacy, etc. But I guess it comes down to a bigger conversation, like who should be, should we be giving all control to the consumers, or should we setting guidelines in place from the very top so that companies
I think there should be some legislation for sure in this whole thing. But it's interesting we talk about young people controlling their own imagery. So influencers absolutely control their imagery. They curate every photograph that's taken of them, mainly through Instagram. Now they're panicking because TikTok isn't curated at all. And there will be new technology, new things coming out. No doubt there will be something coming out around AI. There might be an AI-exclusive version of Instagram. I'm sure there will be something. Actually, that's a good idea. We should patent that immediately.
Okay.
So curation is a big thing in imagery. And as we've been saying, AI can so easily be curated. We use the words AI. I think they're kind of the wrong words, because there's manipulation of imagery, which AI is jolly good at. And there's recreation or creation of imagery, which AI is getting better at, over which we have no control. If it creates images because it scrapes the internet, horrible word, to put all that imagery together, and if none of it's recognizable, then it's free to do what it wants. And it will. But if it tries to manipulate, it was used to manipulate existing imagery, I think that needs to be controlled.
Yeah. I mean, a model, there was an article wasn't about a model saying that AI stole my image. She recognized herself in an image, but it was just so hard to, you know, there was no to evidence.
Yeah, we've talked to lawyers about it, and they say if the model is a day-to-day model as opposed to a supermodel, then does it matter apart from to the model that her image is being used elsewhere? Well, yes, it does.
That makes me boil inside.
Yep. Because 100% right.
You know, we were talking about this before, earlier on, weren't we, before we even started the podcast, about, you know, supermodels are less than 1%, I guess, of, you know, of the whole modeling industry.
Yep.
It's full of working models that make a livelihood. They turn up at 9 o'clock, finish work at 5. They're doing all the e-commerce sites that people love to buy from, and, you know, they're on doing commercials on your TV. They're like really working, and they their whole life is immersed within this. And it's like you can't say that image is less valuable than a supermodel's image.
You absolutely can't. I mean, the fashion industry in the UK is about 100. How many billions and billions? I get the figure wrong. 100 billion pounds. It's huge. It's bigger than the car industry and the aeroplane industry put together. I learnt this yesterday, so it must be true. But for every single one of those billions of dollars that's being spent, or pounds that's being spent, a model is the face of all of those brands. Every brand has a model as the face of that brand. That needs to be respected. I say needs to be, but you know, we have to work at getting people to understand. It's a job. And models earn a living from it, like anybody else does.
Models, do you think they can be created? You know, we're talking about technologies that you said can create anything. And people are starting to create models. You know, you've got virtual influencers, avatars.
Yep.
What makes a model then?
We talked about it before. The most derogatory expression I've heard is that the model is a clothes hanger. And it's not. I think a model is, in my judgment, more of a chameleon, in the sense that a model has to be all sorts of different things, all sorts of people. And I think he or she has to be able to adapt themselves to the needs of the brand that he or she is representing. And when a model becomes the face of a brand, that needs to be respected and that needs to be properly rewarded, because the model is then overtly associated with a particular brand. So I think model as a chameleon is a much better definition. And I think that a nice definition, actually, what a model does. But at the end of the day, a model is also human. It's not a blank canvas on which you can paint anything. It's not an it, it's a person, it's a human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has to be respected. So, and we've heard, you know, models being mistreated at shoots and just referred to as model, as opposed to being used by their name, and that's just disrespectful and wrong. Models do a very important job, and I think they always will. I don't see that the modeling industry is going to decline as a result of AI.
That's good to know. So we have been working together to look at the contracts that currently exist, mainly you looking at the contracts, because I'm not do not have a legal mind, to kind of bring this in and, you know, make sure that boundaries are set, the client understands what they can work within, they're not gonna, you know, use it beyond the usage terms, they can't just send it to commercial third parties, because, you know, obviously it's not just the team involved, the hair and makeup and stylist, we're now talking about tech companies being involved in the conversation as well. So we need to set those boundaries, and the contract will help to do that. And we've also been looking at a statement of model rights, so they know when they're on set, if they're asked to be digitally scanned or used within any AI imagery, that they know that they have a right to say, okay, I want to be represented in this way. I want you to be transparent with where this is going to be used and how it's going to be used. We've got 10 rights within this document that can be used as a resource. So the steps have been taken. But how do you think we can kind of best move forward and prepare in light of these emerging technologies kind of coming into the industry and being adopted more frequently?
Well, going back to the 10 steps, I think the first thing we need to do is to persuade models they've got to read what they're sent.
Yeah, yeah, we could.
They never open emails.
I am trying.
It's very hard. They need to understand, because a lot of models never come into the agency. They be given jobs and they don't even have to come to the agency to go to the job. So it's very important that they actually understand they have rights in this whole arena. And we, as you rightly say, have incorporated new terms and conditions in our agreements with clients for doing shoots and so on. So I think in terms of moving forward, we have to work hard to try and get legislation to work on our side. And I do believe legislation is going to be important, and awareness, so that everybody understands, models obviously themselves and agencies understand. You know, all the bookers have to understand every time they should ask the question or suggest there will be no AI on this shoot, or there will be no AI after the shoot, or whatever it is. You can't say there'll be no retouching, because AI is a bit like retouching. That kind of happens. I think you just have to make people aware and work harder and harder towards legislation that is protective legislation.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that from a personal point of view, being a model and starting out in this industry and being very bewildered and shy and not knowing I can actually say no to things.
That's important. I think it's very important. Young people, they're getting bossier.
Good.
People, they have a bigger voice than they used to have. Women have a bigger voice, by which I include the majority of models who make it a longer term career. Boys tend not to, but girls absolutely do. And I think they've understood they have a voice. And we're doing things on other levels at the BFMA to make sure models have a voice against abuse. And hopefully they will learn that they can speak up. It's very difficult. You're on a set with a bit of a bullying photographer and a very strong designer or whatever. And for you to say, excuse me, that's not right.
Yeah.
Is very, very difficult. But I also work with Creative UK that represents freelancers across the whole country. It's the biggest freelance organisation, a very powerful organisation. And we've introduced a whole programme of activity about freelance individuals being able to say, just say no. And that's what it's about. Say no. No. Stop. No.
Yeah. Say no. Call your agent.
They have to be able to do it.
Yeah.
Exactly. So. Yeah. Teach them to say no.
Well, I'm glad that people are starting to say no, because I have heard that, you know, models have turned up on set. There's been like a scanner. They've asked to be stripped down to their underwear, step into this scanner to be scanned. And they've just done it, you know, because they don't know anything otherwise. And that's what they think they've been booked for. So they haven't questioned it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if anything that doesn't seem right or they feel uncomfortable about, they definitely need to say no, pick up the phone, or, you know, get your agency to say no for you, which I often used to do through Models One. but I guess I'm just going to wrap everything up and just, you know, that kind of speculative question that we want to end with was, where do you think the industry will be? And I'm going to say 20 years, because I think things are moving so rapidly. Where do you think it's going to be in 20 years?
How many years?
20.
Well, if as I told you before, 20 years ago, there wasn't an internet. There certainly wasn't AI.
Crazy!
You know, it's very difficult. Where will it be in 20 years? It'll still be there.
Yeah.
Of that I'm absolutely certain, because fashion will still be there. Design will still be there. People will always want to buy new clothes and so on. There's a whole issue of sustainability, which will have a huge impact on the fashion industry, which is one of the least sustainable industries in the world.
Yeah.
And one of the most damaging to the environment in all sorts of different ways. I think it'll get to pull itself together, but the models who represent the brands will continue to be there. So I'm actually very positive in my outlook for our industry, the modelling industry, for the future. It will change, and I think we have to evolve. We're a bit stubborn as an industry, saying it'll never happen. It's kind of grow up. It's going to happen, and stop pretending it's not. Things will change. You know, who'd have known TikTok would have been just around the corner, and Instagram thought it had got it for life. Then suddenly here comes TikTok. There'll be another TikTok. I don't know what it'll be. And people will adopt it. And there will be a role for models at various different levels of different medium that are being created, which we can't even think about. So I'm as convinced as I can be that even though I won't be here in 20 years' time.
Don't say that, not. John, you'll be here forever. You'll be an avatar.
Yeah, I could be an avatar.
We can scan you. I must get
that done. I must get that done, yeah. The model industry will thrive and will survive, of that I'm sure. It will have to learn to evolve and work with new technologies and not try and constantly to fight it. But the models need to be protected, and that will never change. That has to be done. They're people. They need protection.
Well, thank you for you and the BFMA and the agencies that are a part of that, you know, to taking this seriously, because we need to. You know, the modern industry is a really amazing case study, I think, for the wide implications that it could potentially have. But there was a really nice quote that I love, because it really touches upon what you said, and it was in a book called Age of Earthquakes. You need to read it. And it said, truth is, human behavior never changes.
Yeah.
Only technology does.
Yeah, very true.
So I think we can wrap it up on that.
It's a wrap.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, John.